Can you see me? You need to... Okay. Official? Okay. We will convene the subcommittee of the subcommittee of the public safety ways and means committee. We will do the Thursday, April 29th edition public hearing on House Bill 5055. Oregon Youth Authority, and I believe first up will be Mr. William McGee for BAM.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services, for the record. We'll finish the Youth Authority's budget today, we hope, with the administration, capital improvement, and capital construction.
Excuse me, Mr. McGee, we will finish the Oregon Youth Authority budget today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, you've got, you know, so many guest members here.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'm all ears.
Thank you, member of the committee. The governor's revised budgets for these program units are $10.2 million general fund and $18.1 million total fund. That's a 16.1% increase over the 97-99 legislature approved general fund budget. Total funds are reduced by 24% from the legislative budget, primarily because of capital construction limitation for projects that have been completed or in the process of being completed. The key points to discuss in these units are the reduction of positions, in service and supplies and administration, and an increase in funds to address $7.2 million deferred maintenance backlog in OYA facilities. The 97-99 ledge adopted budget started with $8 million general fund and $14.5 million total fund, 43.5 full-time positions. Emergency board actions included the salary adjustments and additional adjustment information systems funding. Current service level adjustments were position and inflationary cost changes, phase out of capital construction limitations for completed facilities. We have two policy packages here. In the administration unit, we have just slightly reduced the professional services inflation rate, $454 general fund, $477 total funds. Capital improvement, the governor's budget had $500,000 in general funds to begin to address the $7.2 million deferred maintenance backlog. Projects include the design of the new administration building in McLaren that the department will want to talk to you about some more. Remodeling of the building in Hillcrest, replacement of a cooling and air conditioning system in Hillcrest, and installation of a security fence at the Youth Correctional Facility in Warrington. There is no capital construction in the governor's recommended budget or in the governor's revised budget. The revisions in the governor's revised are reduction in service and supplies, a shift of the capital improvement policy package of $500,000 general fund to other funds, and a request to move $134,700 to capital construction from capital improvement, correcting the statement that was made. We also are capturing savings in Attorney General costs for the reduction in hourly rates for some of these prior actions in the Department of Justice budget. We're asking for an increase in other funds expenditure limitations for JGIS. There'll be a larger carryover of funds from this biennium in terms of what we'll spend. And we're funding a request to fund a new COP management assessment from the state treasurer. The net impact is a reduction of $764,000 in general funds from the governor's recommended budget and an increase of $842,000 total.
Thank you, Mr. McGee. Any questions for Bill at this juncture? If not, we'll see the head of Mr. Johnson, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dick Johnson. I am the Assistant Director for Business Services for the Oregon Youth Authority. This afternoon, I'll be presenting information from the Youth Authority's presentation document, the cover document, and we'll begin on page 57, which is the first page under the administration tab. I'll be presenting three areas of Youth Authority budget this afternoon, and those are highlighted in the top pie chart to the left of page 57. Those areas are the administration decision unit. Be talking then about capital budgets, And lastly, about debt service. And following my presentation, Rick Hill and Aaron Brazo will be returning to the table for wrap-up, final questions, and hopefully we'll conclude our hearings with that. The first part of the budget that I'll be presenting is the administration decision unit, and the lower or second pie chart on page 57 breaks that into three sections that will comprise the substance of our remarks. The first area we'll be talking about is briefly the director's office, then the business services office, and then finally a category we call agency-wide, which is central services, intergovernmental charges, and the rest. So those are the three areas that will be covered at this time. It is the goal of the OYA administration to provide leadership and program direction, policy development, management, and oversight to the entire agency. We have specific goals for 1999-2001 that I've listed at the top of the section labeled goals. Short note on these, we do have an emphasis on assuring community protection by strengthening accountability in our system. I believe Rick will be covering that in his final comments. We plan to expand our use of local planning and co-management for a stronger juvenile justice system in Oregon. Third, we'll be reducing juvenile crime through implementation and monitoring of effective programs. Fourth, we'll be completing the development of the juvenile justice information system and linking it to the other juvenile justice services and organizations at state and local levels. Karen Brazil will be adding additional information on that goal. And finally, a personal favorite is that we'll be simplifying our business systems and taking advantage of some of the efficiencies that JGIS will offer us in conducting our business transactions, paying bills and so forth, contracting and the rest. The services that we provide, again, the Office of the Director provides overall direction to the agency, coordinates agency communications and community relations and program management. Business services is divided into four principal organizational units. The first for discussion is the accounting services. They develop and administer the agency's fiscal policy and assure the integrity of all of our financial transactions and records. Pay bills, prepare the payroll, invoices, they receive money, something that a lot of agencies don't do. We manage trust accounts for all of the youth who come into our residential components, whether they be in the institutions or in community placements or foster care. We deposit into those accounts monies from parents who are obligated to support their youth while in state care and other sources that are available to the youth. And we assess the cost of our services to those trust funds. So we actually operate a banking account from which we reimburse the state for those expenses for each youth. That is managed by the accounting section. Finally, they do all of the other normal accounting things, the financial statements and a host of other accounting functions. The second category or area in business services is information services. They maintain the existing system, and for the last couple of years and for the next 2 years, we'll be spending a very large percentage of their time working on the implementation and completion of the JGIS project. We maintain a statewide data communications and support of 600 OYA computers, as well as assisting counties in preparation for the implementation and maintenance of juvenile justice information system. The third category is employee services. where we administer labor agreements and provide all of the employee support functions for the agency. It starts with recruitment, screening, grading applications, and then we get closer to selection. We do criminal records checks on employees. Drug testing is accomplished, and we have a pre-screening series of physical tests to assure that the people who are called on in our direct service group life areas are physically up to the tasks that they'll be performing. In addition, this is the group that negotiates and administers our labor agreements and does all of the routine bookkeeping and accounting for employee services, positions, classifications, and the rest of the normal duties in this area. Finally, in business services, we have a section that's called budget and contracts. This is a marriage of really two separate functions. The budget staff develop, allocate, monitor budgets. They analyze the expenditures and revenue trends, make projections on where we are at any given moment and where we expect to be, recommend mid-course corrections on how and where we should be managing our funds more tightly, and assure that the agency is achieving its goals in a financial sense. The contract section, prepare and monitor 1,000 agency contracts in a biennium, and they're assuring that we're also making appropriate legal agreements with intergovernmental agencies, and they're also assure that we are in compliance with the contracting rules, the state requirements. I think that covers business services, and if there are no questions, I'd like to turn to page 58.
Mr. Johnson, this is the Awakening Public Safety Club. We always have questions, and Representative Schrader is leading the pack. I just had two questions. So I'll ask the first one. If it's good enough, I'll let you ask the second one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I assume at some point in time we'll get a breakout of the gauger system costs from the budget and how it's evolved from last session or two. I understood from previous testimony we're going to be done with it at the end of this biennium, so I'd like to get that broken out at some point.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schrader, we can provide that information. It's not in your book, but I do have the latest cost projections for the JGIS system that we can share with the committee.
Quick question on the budget contract. What position level do you have handling your contract at this point? Is it an account level one individual? Is it a purchase analyst three? What is the job description of an individual that's running the contracts?
We have two individuals who are direct air contracts officers. Let me refer to my position detail. They are at different classifications at present. Administration. We have one grants coordinator, which is a salary range 24, and one program rep 1, which is a salary range 26.
Follow up real quick. The reason I ask the question is in other committees and other sessions, it's come to our attention that sometimes that a lot of these individuals don't have experience with RFPs and they're looking for really significant contracts. So I'll go back and review what the qualifications for those are and see if they're doing the right thing or not.
I can say, Mr. Chairman, Representative Schrader, that we are looking at those. There is a request to consider a reclassification to the Program Tech 2 classification. That is still under review, and we have not been able to complete the work on that. Our staff, our two staff, do conduct
the RFP process, the hearings, the various conferences that go on with prospective bidders, and have received some training in that and are preparing to go to some of the new Department of Administrative Services training that they are developing at this time and will soon be providing statewide. So we hope we're doing it right. We think we are, and we've avoided lawsuits to date. But better than some. And that's a DOJ savings.
Just share this with me, I think that's it.
There it is.
Question with regards to the food service part of the business. I remember in DOC last session we saved, I can't remember what it means, but hundreds of thousands of dollars in regards to different methods. And I think right now the Food Service of America, the head guy in it, took the job in Ontario and they have their own warehouse and whatever. There's a lot of ways to save money on food. Do you have a specialist in that area that can look at it and figure out where the best, what the best buying methods are, so you can get the best prices from the warehouse yourself in any way? I know your facilities are not big. It's 40, like in Burns. It's very, it's not that big, but it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's probably the best account in town. Sysco comes in, sells everything from them. Or from here, I think, where the Sysco trucks come from. To go to the, there should be a discount when you go into those towns to the local guys that are selling anything because they can't compete with them. So you should get a better price out of them.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kins, we participate and purchase our food through the state price agreements. Those are negotiated. It's my information. I'm not an expert on that, and nor do we have one at the youth authority. We rely on DAS to assist us in that through the price agreement and their procurement process. And as we are told, we're obligated to purchase under those price agreements. They have been bid and awarded on the basis of a competitive process, and we're somewhat obligated to use those. So for the specifics on our food, we primarily purchase through those agreements. We get weekly deliveries from Sysco, and we do not have large storage space in our new facilities. Our older facilities have slightly larger capacity, but I believe they still take delivery of those commodities. Years ago, we used to transact business with the state penitentiary and buy potatoes from the farm, and things have changed quite a bit over the years. And the last analysis we did several years ago seemed to indicate that this was the most cost-effective way to go.
Mr. Chair, you're saying that the DAF have people that handle this purchasing for probably all facilities in the state of Oregon, or all the ones that OYA, but not Department of Corrections, would be separate, or they purchase through the Department of Corrections. There's something, it makes sense that somebody in state government and DAS would be the place that would be administering or helping administer this program for the efficiencies and costs.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Bill McGee from DAS. We have a group that negotiates price agreements for purchases of different products. We go out and competitively bid things and attempt to use our size as a state to get the best deals we can get. We don't actually do the purchasing for the agencies. They do that themselves, but we attempt to
get the agreement
to try and get the best prices we can.
Good. Thank you.
I could augment the answer to Senator Kim's question. In other areas apart from food, we are presently looking at our warehousing and distribution systems in the Youth Authority. We have in the governor's budget signed up for significant efficiencies, reductions, and costs. And as part of our effort to pursue those, we're looking to make sure that we have the most efficient distribution system on the rest of our commodities, such as clothing and blankets and the rest of those kinds of things. We're considering comparing our current system, which is kind of a hybrid of things,
with what DOC is proposing. You know, they're in the process of a new venture to provide their institutions and other customers with warehouse and distribution services, and we're looking at the product they will be offering, and we're also looking at certain where it makes sense to not warehouse. I mean, one of the questions we ask ourselves is if you need a small quantity of an occasional item, would it not be better to use a Visa card and buy from a local vendor? And in some cases, I think that will turn out to be the answer. So that is a study we started a month ago and hope to complete in the next month. And it could result, hopefully will result in savings.
Good answer. Interesting to I've never heard that. Man, I'm in that type of business. I used to sell to everybody. The job court came to Orange County. I felt, and you can't sell to these people. Because you can't compete for the Cisco's. It all comes out of the same report. Which is a shame, because the local people support the facilities, and one of them there, they don't get any out of them, but I can see the problem. Another problem they have, but we'll tell you about that. the point is, it's too bad the local folks can't do it, because it's just no way that they can sell it to them and compete.
True. If we could push everybody's budgets.
Well, I thought about putting in a deal for 6%. If my son at home can be within 6% of the price, he should get the business because he's local. Well, I'm not sure I want to do that. I think it should be competitive. And the little guy's in trouble in this economy anyway, so quite fighting.
Any other questions for Dick?
For future. I'd like to begin on page 58 at this time. Briefly describe our agency-wide budget. It's kind of just that section of our budget where we accumulate the central service costs, do not allocate them out. Want to make sure we've got adequate funds to pay for Mr. McGee's organization and the other assessments and services that we receive from state sources. And it's just a category of costs that's isolated and that's all there is to it.
Great.
I would like to draw the committee's attention to the next two paragraphs, however. Agencies are required to have legislative approval to use petty cash funds and property damage reimbursement funds. And through our budget, we are requesting the committee's approval of these two categories. Through oversight, we at one time were awarded this authority as an agency within DHR. It is less clear today that we have that authority, and we will request the committee either enter, I believe the latest advice from legislative council is that we could put the authority in the agency's budget bill. But briefly, the first account would be to establish a $100 petty cash fund at each of our facilities and parole probation offices. This would enable our staff to buy lunches for traveling youth or other small purchases and be reimbursed. This money is not new money. It's not an appropriation we're requesting. It is our regular operating funds. It's just a purchasing mechanism that requires special recognition and approval from the legislature. So we would ask for that it would be about a total of $4,400 from existing resources.
Mr. Chair?
$4,400.
Yeah, I'd like this and raise it to $500 if I spend it locally. Good idea. What do you think of that? I'm just kidding.
it points out, though, I mean, one of the... You know, we sometimes take this accountability thing too far, and it's, you know, we just handcuff the agency, all of them. You know, and they're more abound in some of the rules that we write for them. I mean, common sense would tell you they ought to be able to have $100 laying around just to take care of stuff, things, whatever.
Mr. Chairman, it is fully accounted for.
Right.
The implication
that it wasn't. It's just, you know, we'll spend $5,000 diddling around, printing paper, and doing all this stuff to give the authority to have 4,400 laying around. But that's a different story.
Representative Nance.
I do think that at some point we probably need to have a generic solution to that problem in terms of some authorization across the board for agency directors to have some flexibility about how they can handle things. And I'll give you an example, and then I'll stop. For years, when I've gone to the Workers' Compensation Board here in Salem for hearings, the nice lady who runs reception has all kinds of little candies and coffees out there for people who have to be there for hours because the bureaucracy never provided for any of this stuff. She does that all out of her own pocket, and if people make little contributions, and that she takes care of it. And it's a great convenience to the folks who are there, but the agency budgeting process would be horrific to talk about having some appropriation and some accounting for, you know, a roll of lifesavers or for a cup of coffee. And it's just a minor example of where we get so rigid that we don't allow any common sense. Fortunately, that agency just kind of says, you know, do this on, and do this for the benefit of the people that are there. And I dare say if we sent some auditors over there, they would find wrongdoing because it's not being run through the agency appropriation. Maybe I shouldn't even have brought it up on the record. But to me, at some point, we ought to talk about that, and this highlights the issue, that's why.
That before or after we talk about slush funds and committee chairs? There's some nexus here.
Yeah.
Dick?
I think we can accommodate this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excessive request.
The second excessive request deals with a similar amount of money. About $5,000 is our request, from which we would reimburse our employees whose clothing or property is damaged in the regular official pursuit of their duties. We occasionally have scuffles with our youth, and in the process, an employee's shirt may be torn, and this would permit the agency to use state funds to reimburse that employee's loss. It is a provision in both our collective bargaining agreement, and it has only come to light recently that, again, legislative permission is required, and we would ask that as a note of some kind in the budget bill. It is agency funds, no new appropriation. And in fact, we have been doing this in absence of such clear authority. So this is current practice.
Just so the written record reflects my sarcasm in excessive, I was not being serious when I said their request for the petty cash fund was excessive.
Can you type all that down?
Anyway.
Sarcasm never comes across on the type of paper.
Mr. Chair, it is our understanding that the petty cash action can be taken in the language in the budget report on property damage that would need to be included in the appropriations bill. I believe your staff has checked the legislation.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's the appropriation bill.
Page 59 displays a summary of OIA's administration budget. I think the first column is the current service level, the second column the numbers, the governor's recommended budget. There is virtually no change. The only change is the $477 bill mentioned earlier with regard to a recalculation of inflation. Page 60 displays the agency funding for these services. We are primarily a general fund organization. The additional costs reflected here are other funds in support of the JAGIS project, both from grant funds and from certificates of participation. Finally, the federal government allows us a small percentage on our costs, just a calculated amount based on their percentage of our program side. Page 61 is a comparison between the governor's recommended budget and the revised budget.
Again, Bill has already indicated the major changes here. There are three technical adjustments and $274,000 in general fund reductions in services and supplies. We have, but Bill's already mentioned the adjustments, reductions in the Attorney General's rates. The State Treasury is charging a fee now for managing certificates of participation, and we expect to carry over more of our first bond certificates of participation, and we need the limitation that we originally had in this biennium move to next biennium to roll those funds forward.
Hold on, Bill. How much is the State Treasury charging ourselves to manage our own money?
Would be $20,447 general fund, 21.
What percent is that of the cops that are managed?
We have about $13 million worth of principal payments this coming biennium. I'm not sure if it's on that or on the full outstanding value. I don't know the rules.
Mm. Mr. Chair, I do have a schedule back in the office that details their cost breakout. This is a charge to those agencies that have certificates of participation outstanding. So I can get that for the committee.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not throwing rocks at you guys.
Mr. Chairman, that completes my presentation on the administration area. And if there are more questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Any questions for Dick on the administrative division?
Move
that away clean.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd next like to talk about our capital budgeting and refer to page 62, which is directly under the capital budgeting tab in your book. This chapter describes our real property assets, and it departs a little bit from the budget rules in that they divide things up into different categories, and this attempts to put it all back together in one presentation. Some of the costs of operating our facilities are in our regular S&S budget. Some of them are in capital improvement budgets. We'll talk briefly about capital construction a little later as an adjustment. This is an attempt on our part to put all of the funds that are in all parts of our budget, both our base budget and a package that the governor is recommending to increase capital improvement investments in the youth authority, all in one place, compared against a comprehensive needs assessment that we had performed. And I'll be talking a bit more about that in a minute, but I'll try and point out where this is a little bit can be confusing. If you're used to looking at capital improvement parts of the budget, I've also included in here operating funds that are also used for that purpose. I just wanted to make sure that the committee understands that this is a departure from normal budget rules. Just as an overview, we own and operate 60 buildings at 12 locations around the state. And the replacement value has been calculated at $106 million. As I mentioned, during the 97-99 biennium, we completed the construction of 5 new facilities and 1 youth accountability camp. Those are in excellent condition. We also have some older facilities, and during this past biennium, we engaged an engineering firm, one that had previously done some work for the Department of Corrections, inventorying their properties, coming in doing a physical assessment of the situation, noting what the deficiencies were, making estimates on what it would cost and how urgent some of those repairs were. So we did a comprehensive review of our older facilities, and that forms the basis for our capital projects request. And we've developed a 6-year plan in response to budget instructions, and I'll be going through the details of that in just a few minutes. The top pie chart, however, is a representation of that 6-year plan in a very high level. It comes out to about a $13.4 million list.
In this next biennium, we're hoping to spend about a little over $1 million in the highest priority items on that list, leaving for the next two biennia approximately $6 million each of those two biennia to complete the list. We'll be updating this, and that's about all I can say about that pie chart. The next second pie chart breaks the $1.1 million into three pieces, and that's where my budget rule bending occurs. The first piece, the gray shaded piece, is really our S&S budget. It is part of our operating funds. We won't see it in the capital construction or capital improvement chapters. It is money that we have in our agent in our institutional budgets to take care of leaking faucets and roofs and the rest. The second piece that's in our base is a $200,000 amount that we have had in previous biennia, and by budget rules, we are requesting again to spend that $200,000. The third piece is a package the governor recommends, which would allow us to go further down the list of repairs, and that package in the original budget, as Bill mentioned, was a general fund request, and in the revised budget, we are seeking other funds limitation, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. As I said, our newer facilities are in excellent shape. Our older facilities have some work to be done. On pages 63, 64, and 65, there are three biennial plans. So the 63 is the 9901 plan, followed by page 64 and 65, which would be the two subsequent biennial plans. Just as a note, conditions may change and our priorities may change. We may discover a new problem that needs attention more urgently than something on this list, and we're always wanting to protect our assets and have the flexibility and request your approval of that flexibility to move the money to meet the emergent needs of the organization. So while this list represents today's thinking, it could change next week.
Mr. Chairman.
Sure,
The money that you're talking about could change next week. There's nothing to prevent you from taking within your base budget from one area and shifting over to meet those kind of emergency decisions and then come back to the E-Board and ask for the release of additional funds, is there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, there is no technical impediment to that. That's correct. There is a concern about expending funds that are intended to support one activity and coming to the emergency board and not finding the support there for an action that an agency takes. So we generally don't like to get out in front of the emergency board, but there are no, well, take that back. We might have to, in some cases, request a change from operating budget to capital improvement, which is more of an accounting kind of approval than anything else.
But it's taken within the existing funds for your budget.
Yeah, we can do that.
Thank you, sir. Dick,
I want to follow up on my own question, back up just a little bit. On those costs that you have out, about $13 million worth, and the Treasury's charging you $20,000, round numbers, biennially, that's to manage that or for issuance?
Mr. Chairman, this is a new charge. I believe it is to manage the COPs, the investment. I believe that DAS issues the COPs. Perhaps Mr. McGee is closer to this than I.
Mr. Bill McGee. This is for the Treasury's cost in administering the dollars, the portion of this, as they receive and manage the actual cash. We manage the sale, but they manage the cash. So this is their cost to do that. And we're talking about actually more than $13 million. The page 72 shows that the overall debt service for the COPs that are outstanding for the agency, there's remaining, the second part of the chart, there's still remaining $62 million to pay off on the regional facilities, another $3.5 million on fences and so on going across there. So we're, if you're looking at the total amount of debt that the Treasury is managing for us, it's getting on to about $70 to $75 million worth.
But not all of that is cops.
This is all COP principal and interest repayment. The amount, the COP amount that they're managing for this agency. From now on through 2012.
Okay, so let me get this straight in my rummy little brain here. You handle the issuance.
We negotiate with the financial markets and work on the paperwork. They handle the cash.
Okay, so you get the deal cut,
right,
with whatever the institution, or even in some cases it could be an individual, I guess, but whatever the institution or company is, you cut the deal and get the cash.
Yes. That's true. It is through, there are certain financial firms that we work through there. I think there are three of them that actually handle the mechanics of the sale back east and do that.
The bottom line is you get the cash for, pick a $5 million issuance. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I understand there's issuance costs and due diligence and all that good stuff that has to be done. You get the cash. That goes to Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
Do the projects as they're completed, almost like a construction loan? Because COPS, it's the physical, it's the institution that's the collateral for the loan, as opposed to the good faith and credit of the state of Oregon.
Right.
Okay, so then is that cash from the institution that you're dealing with, one of the three, the deal cut, you've got the commitment, does that cash show up all at once?
When you make the sale of a particular series of COPs, yeah, the cash, we would get the cash at one time. It's then invested, and there is an assumption built in to the schedule that we will get some interest on that. So I think I know where you're going.
Okay. But then for the management of that lump sum of cash, the Treasury, on top of having the cash sitting there, is getting paid some figure. I've got it broken down to 0.00154, but whatever the management fee is.
That's right. Correct.
They get paid some
21,000 issued to this agency, but yeah.
So is that 21,000 on 13 million, as Dick indicated, or on the 75?
Well, the $13 million is what we'll pay next biennium on the whole 75. So it's a question whether you're looking at the long-term piece or just the one biennium payment. We will pay $13,999.01. By the time these things retire, we'll pay another 75.
So it's the 20,000, the cash in play, in essence. Oh, right. It's the cash in play. Okay, that answers my question.
Just a couple of points
here.
I'm not sure this is done properly. When you look at the interstate 5.2% rate of the interest, and you look at this is COP is probably the most cost efficient manner of doing the financing. Or if you go to long-term bonds or whatever, the other type of bonding.
It costs more money. Mr. Chair, Senator Kim.
Not necessarily so. It depends on the time.
Well, this agency does not have authority to issue general obligation bonds.
That's right.
There is no revenue source for this agency to fund revenue bonds. So really, the long-term...
All you can do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. She did not have general obligations. I mean, we try to do something about that and never got it done, right? It's the same with DOC.
They also do not have that authority. There was some discussion in the past, but nothing happened on that.
So we are required to use
CMR.
we'll pay for it out of current operating costs.
But there is the question, there is a variable between the two many times. Depends on whether what type of funding you want, the length of the funding.
Sure, that ends it.
There are many ways to play the game.
Sure.
And that statutory constitutional requirement, not statutory.
Trying to change it once, I think.
I think there was some attempts maybe last session, the session before, but it didn't move.
Our long-term debt, we're in great shape. So why not do it the most efficient way to get the money? And then we don't do that with Department of Corrections. We have to do it through COP.
With the Constitution currently as it is, yes.
So that is Constitution, not statutory.
Correct, sir.
We're going to get that back. I'm just trying to. That must be Manny's fault. He's always thinking about that.
Please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to return to page 63 and make a couple of brief comments. I've already mentioned, I believe, that the $500,000 capital improvement package number 408, which is the last set of projects there, we propose to shift that from general fund to other funds. We're exploring the sale of some property that is outside the fence at McLaren, and with the proceeds of that being deposited in the capital investment fund at Bass, we would use those funds to accomplish some of these projects. And so therefore we believe that we can achieve this plan without that additional $500,000 in general fund. So that is a change I wanted to highlight in the original budget. There is also a technical adjustment.
Excuse me, Dick. Senator Hannah.
No, it was better, Senator.
Oh, it was such a good question. Senator Kent.
Thank you. I'm sorry to ask me a question. I kind of like to get into it a little for you.
You can go.
You feel good about it.
We can go tomorrow.
Do you have any other inventory of... You know, you never look at this. I've been around here a little while, and you never look at the inventory that you have as far as extra land. Now you're saying you're selling part of it, and I've been out there and looked at the land around the fence, farmland, good farmland, I believe. And do we ever look at our inventory? Do you have a running account of the inventory of land that you have?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kim, yes, we do. We are not large landowners. The single largest parcel, of course, is McLaren. We recently sold, I believe, about 80 acres to the city of Woodburn.
Mm-hmm.
Some years ago, 20-some years ago, we had an agreement with them in which they built the sewage treatment plant on state property out there, and we finally determined that we were unlikely to recover the use of that land. And so we sold it to them with some additional acreage between us. We are looking at this new parcel as well. It's probably about 10 acres. And the reason we're considering it today is in the past it was a buffer to keep residential uses at some distance from our unfenced facility. Now that we're putting a fence in, it allows us to reconsider how much buffer we need and for what purpose. And it is that freedom now that allows us to consider this sale.
Good for you. Don't see it very often.
Good question.
Good. It's going to make us any money.
Yeah, could you confine your questions to those that garner general funds?
Final comment on
you taught me everything I know.
Yes, you're right, dear. You're in trouble.
Page 63 is that we are requesting a technical adjustment. Ms. McGee mentioned it. We would like to take from this $500,000, we would like to establish a capital construction
appropriation for the purposes of doing some design work on the replacement of the administration building at McLaren. Staff has a notebook that we recently, we had the fortune, I guess maybe misfortune is more accurate. We noticed that the wall on the administration building was beginning to buckle. It's the stucco front, and it had started to separate from the structure, which caused it to peak underneath. And what you'll see in the notebook are the pictures of what is going on under the stucco. And I think it's a very telling set of pictures, but the engineers, as they reviewed the structure last year, also identified this building as one whose life has come and gone, and they're proposing that we seriously consider replacing the building. Its replacement cost, its repair cost is about half of its replacement cost. And this would allow us then to do the initial planning design work under, again, the budgeting rules. We have to ask you 2 years before we want to build something for permission to proceed and do the design work. That is why we're here today, and we believe that would cost about $134,000 in architectural and engineering planning. So we would like to begin that process. And
is this in McLaren then?
Yes, sir.
This is one of the outdated older facilities.
Yes, sir.
I noticed a lot of scaffolding here in the pictures. Would it be more prudent to just tear it down and replace it than it would be to try to restore it? And there seems to be a lot of rotting structures underneath the floors and everything else.
Mr. Hannon, that's exactly what we would ask you for permission to do.
But you have to design it first.
This is to design the replacement building, not to work on this old structure.
Okay.
We will have to keep this older structure operational. It's the only building we've got out there to house our administrative functions. Our estimate for patching this up, nothing fancy, just replacing the timber and making sure we're structurally safe, is less than $20,000. That will allow us to continue to occupy this building for the next few years as we proceed to develop and build the alternative.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kins.
When you do this, of course you go through GSA, right? General Services.
Yes, sir.
Everything is handled through them as far as, because they have the experts and instruction and so forth.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Timms, they do have the experts. We will likely be contracting competitive bid with an architect to assist us in the design of this, but they have been very active in helping us manage these projects as we built our new institutions and boot camps. They have assisted in the contracting and in the selection, and they have had some additional participation in our building management process as we meet with the contractors and the architects throughout the project. So we work with them closely.
He built five facilities all at the same time on a prototype. I've always heard that Rick Hill was a genius. Shirley Stahl told me that. How he put all these buildings together and built them all at the same time and came out just perfect, not like the Department of Corrections who had problems. Now, did he do that or did GSA do that?
I did that, Senator. Chairman, Senator Timms, I think that's a good question for the concluding panel to...
Yes, we'll keep that in the burner for you.
Okay, moving on.
Dick, I've got to interrupt a couple of this and show my ignorance. I mean, is this fire in some of this stuff? Was there a fire that they built over? That's just rot? Just the black there?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding that certainly there was no fire, that in fact what has happened, you may notice at the bottom there's some white blocks
kind of in there. What that is a newly, I don't know when it was added, but after the damage was done, it was discovered that moisture had come up from the crawl space under the building and condensed, and what you see there is the result. It's good old-fashioned dry rot.
Okay? Gotta say hi to someone.
Okay. If there are no questions on the capital projects pages, I'd like to turn to page 66. This is just a recap of what we've been talking about. It shows you that we're requesting to spend $500,000 more in capital improvements. That is from the package that we will finance through the sale of property. That has been refunded in the governor's revised budget, and I think that's just all recap. If I can then turn page 67.
Before we leave, Ms. Sherman. On 66, it has the capital improvements, then the governor's revised budget capital improvements. It appears that both of them allow for package 408, which is phase one of 6 years. What's the potential ultimate cost for the 6 year? In other words, this is one phase. How many phases? And it goes up to 6 years?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, that budgeting rules ask agencies to always maintain a six-year plan. Our six-year plan is about $13.3 million. And this is, however much money you've got, we could spend. And these three pages, page 63 through 65, are the $13 million. So depending on how much we have available to us, we would take these projects in priority order.
And the other question we have is, $500,000 part of the land sale that would generate the $500,000?
Yes, sir.
And once it was used, would there be a somewhat a revolving fund to always be able to work out of, a capital construction fund?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hannon, that's not the way this particular fund works. I mean, an agency who disposes of property, the proceeds from that go into a DAS fund.
Right.
An agency under statute can make a request of DAS to reinvest that proceed in further capital projects. We have been told that they would approve such a request from us, but once that money is gone, if we sell the property for $500,000, that's all there is. Once it's invested, we're through.
Okay.
We would have to sell additional property, or maybe DOC would give us the proceeds of something they might sell. I doubt it, but it is limited to what's deposited.
Okay. So if it's sold for $500, that's what you're asking for authority to spend.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Senator Kent, we'll price and land. What's the sell for an acre?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kent, we have not proceeded far in our planning for this. Right now it's zoned as public use land. It might depend on what it could be zoned as. It might have commercial value. Right now it's got three old homes of little value, in my opinion. I'm not an appraiser, but...
And you don't know how many acres are there?
We have considered approximately a 10-acre parcel, but that is still...
Fail. And that is going to fund, that doesn't make sense, that is going to fund the six-year capital project of $500,000 on phase one of the program.
Well,
We're getting a little carried away there, Karen. What do you think?
Okay. He's just looking for a retirement home.
Yeah, I want to make sure somebody doesn't get a bargain.
They own some property at the Cape Center. I'm sure they'd like to get some special for you.
Get rid of me that way.
Mr. Chairman, if I don't move on, my boss will be angry at me.
I just got permission from him for us to pummel you for as long as you like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may draw your attention to page 67, I'd like to talk a bit about our capital construction future needs. We talked a bit about one of our driving forces, which are old and deteriorating buildings. We have more than that, but we're saving those for the next session. The second driver, I'd like to draw your attention to the charts. You'll also find those on pages 69 and 70 of your budget book. This represents the available bed space for us in our closed custody secure facility. The solid line is what we have space for. We've got that many beds at any point in time. Right now, we have some temporary, we're building a new facility, 50 beds over in Eastern Oregon. They're not online yet. Will not be added until approximately the shows at January. Online a little earlier than that. We're also doing some remodel work at Hillcrest to do the renovations you authorized, or the emergency board authorized following the suicide at Hillcrest. So there are space that we have that is temporarily out of use. The dotted line represents the April 1999 second look forecast. That is the original April forecast less 59 beds, and those 59 beds are what we project the savings to be from the second look legislation now in consideration by the legislature. With that projection overlaid against the available capacity, we can predict that in approximately June of 03, we will need to have another 24 bed pod available to receive the that are likely to come through the door at that time. Again, a few months later, another 24 beds. And finally, in the time frame, we would add a third unit in 03-05. Yep.
Mr. Chairman, looking at your projections up here on the second look, where would the graph show the line going under current practices now?
Without a second look.
Good question. Oh, these are question two.
Chart number two. In the April forecast, no second look. Same availability. We would need to begin adding new units, and by the look of it, July of 02, we're going to start, if they are going to be online and ready, we kind of predict an 18-month time to build and get things going. So we would be looking at funds this biennium for not one, but I think three units. So at about, I think they're $1.5 million a unit or so, we're looking at $500,000.
Well, actually, the dotted line would actually go above your capacity line in some places.
Well, this is a capacity line without building, it's in right here.
Yeah.
So,
but even in an 18-month period of building the additional facilities, you're going to probably be pushing up against maximum.
Well, we come close here, and of course, every 6 months as we do a forecast, this line could increase its slope or decrease its slope.
Yeah.
But given what we have to work with in the current forecast,
They can squeak by a couple of times in a year, but eventually we're going to either need the rent space, find it, or build something, and that building, of course, has a timeline that that's for.
Sure.
I can remember when I turned McLaren, and just about everybody out there had committed a major felony murder or whatever, and we had a cap, and we had no place to put these people around here for get. That's who that built. Get how many $1 million in debt since that time, which was 1993, if I remember correctly, when Gordon Smith was the president of the Senate. We went out and looked at it before ballot measure 11 passed, but we wanted to make sure we did something at that time. And we had built these beds, spent a lot of money, which people say, you know. And you look at what we've done in the last 7 years in regards to DOC, youth authority, and the total process of funding education, and a 300% increase in everything that's happened. As capital, we got to be darn proud of what what's been done. And we look at it now as keeping up. What happens if we don't keep up? We didn't have it in those days. We weren't keeping up. I mean, we weren't even coming close to putting kids away. What happens to us? Is there a federal court like there is with DOC? Or we don't have that in the youth authority, do we? We have an obligation to keep those kids?
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms.
Like you did before Republican took control.
We didn't have Measure 11 in the old days either, which means that what would happen in this case, since we don't have a choice with the Measure 11 population coming in, if there were no new beds, at some point every bed would be filled theoretically with the Measure 11 youth, meaning that the lesser offenses would not receive this kind of service. Or you'd be renting beds someplace. Or we'd be renting beds.
I would say programs for kids.
That sounds great.
It's a feel-good statement, Mr. Chair. You know, you always hear how bad we're doing.
Oh, it's not all bad.
Sorry,
Mr. Chairman, that brings us to page 71 about debt service. There may be a few questions remaining. I think that the chart on 72 is a very comprehensive chart. It shows you how much each biennium we are obligated under our current bond sale. It also lists, in the last column, the estimated revenue from a future sale. This would be the bonds required to pay for the completion of the JGIS project. It has not occurred at this time, last biennium. We received approval for about $7.3 million worth of expenditure limitation from COPs. We received the sale of $3.5 million. The remainder was left for a future bond sale, and we would project that that happens at some point. This chart is incorrect in that it was estimated as occurring in May of 99. It will not occur this biennium. It will be sometime in the next biennium. And so this is an estimate. It would have to be changed depending on the date of that sale. If there are no other questions on capital area or debt service, my boss can come to the table.
Well, maybe Karen can come first.
And Dick, I don't know if I was you how I'd interpret this. I mean, when we started, there wasn't anyone at the table except Representative Minnis and myself. And then you drew a full house, and then everybody left. So, I mean,
that's so sorry.
You know.
So you did have full Republican committee here. I mean,
the Senate was in full
for the first time in a long
time. And regalia.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for the first time in 6 months. But, you know, you were here. Thank you, Dick.
Are you both going to come together?
I hope so.
What are you and me doing?
I know. Isn't that horrible? Yeah. And you feel sorry for them? Hey, you got to feel sorry.
When it's all said and done, they're sitting down with you and I anyway, so.
Yeah.
That's fair.
That's fair.
With the chair's permission, for the record, I'm Rick Hill, director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and with me is Karen Brazeau, the deputy director. I'd like to get on the record some responses to some of the questions that have been asked earlier in the earlier days this week, and then let Karen finish up the questions on the JGIS project that were asked, I believe, on Monday and Tuesday, and then I'll just wrap it up with a few comments at the end, if that's all right, Mr. Chair. Question number one, I believe, came from Representative Patridge about what is the washout rate in our youth accountability camp at Tillamook, and we did give an answer for the record, but I wanted to make sure the numbers were correct. During our first year of operation over there, our washout rate was about 30%, and we have corrected that during the second year of operation. It's down to between 12 and 15% for each cycle. And the reason it's improved is because we're doing a better job of selecting youth, and we're operating a staging area in one of the temporary structures at McLaren, so we prepare the youth for the discipline that they receive when they get to the accountability camp.
Excuse me, that was 30%
first year.
First year down to about
12 to 15%.
12 to 15 through better screening.
Okay. Second question, I believe, was asked by Senator Hannon about the eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. I think we tried to answer that the other day, but let me try a simpler approach. The legal status of the youth has nothing to do with the eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. The only thing that matters is the family income. So whether he's on parole, probation, has violated the law or not, or is in our custody or not, doesn't matter. Once, though, he goes into a residential treatment center or a foster home, some type of substance care, either for a delinquency act or, in the case of SCF on a dependency case, they do become eligible because, according to federal rules, they are a family of one with no income. That's how they're coded. So they become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. The exception to this is when youth are in our institutions. They are not eligible for the health plan because they're not eligible for any Medicaid money. That's the federal line drawn in the sand. So that's the simplest way to answer that question.
Mr. Chair, isn't that, Rick, also in line with adults that are in DLC, that they basically are taken off? And I know that we're trying to do some type of connect that if they, once they come out, if they don't, let's say, have an extended period of time of getting reconnected onto the program, do you have any information about how that would work or if it's being done at the youth level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cousins, yes, that is the same situation in the Youth Authority as in the Department of Corrections, and that's one of the functions that our parole officers serve in maintaining that connection with the youth when he's in the institution, so that if on leaving the institution he goes into substitute care, he's immediately eligible, or if he goes home, it's determined whether or not the family is eligible.
Well, Rick, backing up just a little bit on your accountability camp, you indicated, I think, that the cost was like $94.81 a day. Is that just the bed cost without the education component?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Yeah, you're getting head nods in the back.
The education is paid for out of the basic school fund. We contract, the Department of Ed contracts with the Tillamook School District. Regardless of where those youth were, that education cost would be the same. I mean,
that's the care, custody, and control cost.
Yeah.
Okay.
The third
here. Question regarding that, because I know we had a problem in Burns with the education funds. Do we have, or do you know, because you don't pay it, school press, but do we know the standard education costs from school district to school district in regards to that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pence, how it works is an amount equal to a double weighting.
I understand how they arrive at the amount, but there are schools, and the Burns school was high. They came in, and the better teachers went to the facility. So the reason is they like the discipline and the retirement, because they do get a better retirement. And
And I don't think you had that problem. It irritated me, to tell you the truth. The school district tried to take it. And they did. They ended up, you had to increase the beds by 2 to get us to where we were in the ball game. So if anybody looking at the disparity between different juvenile facilities and the cost of the education?
Mr. Chair and Senator, since I now understand your question, yes, I work with the Department of Education to maintain that link between the two agencies. And I have not looked at the difference in the cost. I know that each facility has to operate within the appropriation that's given to them. And how that works out in the facility is pretty much how it works out in a public school. If most of the funds go to pay higher salaries, there's less left for other kinds of materials and computers and that sort of thing. So in those facilities where there are newer, less highly paid staff, they have some
other... Pick it up someplace else.
They're not...
You have an economy of scale if you picked it up for... Boy, the equipment there is great. Better than this in school.
I know. Mr. Chair and Senator, since I feel obligated to agree that that is true, and the reason is that it is all new and was purchased when the Department of Education took over the educational program. There were funds appropriated until that time, and Rick remembers this, that there weren't any funds and kids were using textbooks that you and I used. So they do look good in comparison with the public schools, but it was a catch-up. They were so terribly out of date.
Well, the problem I have is you're putting one in Elgin, and I'm smaller in Burnton. So what the situation you get into is I don't like seeing the schools hold you hostage. And that's what they were doing. They were holding you hostage in the program. So to me, a school like Prineville that had a facility, they went out and contracted outside the school district. So they got a much cheaper rate. Burns, they went to the school, so the better school teachers went out there in the process. So we need to me, it is a cost, and it's something that should be looked at, because you're going to have the same problem in Elgin, probably. It's small, it's remote, where else do you go?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pinzon, we have had some experience recently in the Department of Education working through with one of the education providers to not renew that contract, and we are fortunate that in most communities there's a school district and an education service district, and there's a little bit of competition there. So, and that was the whole point of contracting with a local education agency. If things don't work, have other alternatives.
And it's amazing how they try and sap the system. And they do it, get away with it. That's what irritates me.
Continuing, Mr. Chair, the third question I'd like to respond to was, I believe, also from Representative Thatcher, had to do with determinate sentencing versus indeterminate sentencing as we were projecting our beds, and how do we predict how many beds we're going to need. The state of Washington Juvenile Justice Department uses determinate sentencing. We called them this week and got their comments on the comparisons, and I've I want to say that there are advantages and disadvantages to having determinate sentencing in juvenile correction. Several of the advantages are it's easier to forecast the number of beds you're going to need because you know how long the youth are going to stay. There's also a reduction in the disparity among from county to county or jurisdiction to jurisdiction and how youth are treated for the same criminal activity. And that also impacts the disproportionate minority confinement, and it reduces it. It also gives truth in sentencing, which is important to crime victims and important in the criminal justice process. The disadvantages, however, in the opinion of my counterpart in the state of Washington, far outweigh the advantages. The sentences are not rationally linked to the length of time a youth needs to go through rehabilitation and reformation. It is not linked to the length time and effort and program necessary to change the youth's behavior. And parole is an option in the Washington system. So the judge can decide whether this determinate sentence is followed up with a transitional period of supervision or not. The result is, on the recidivism side, that if they were to measure recidivism the same way we do, which is what percent of the youth return to the institution within 1 year of their release, of their first release. For whatever reason, whether it's a law violation or a behavioral problem, ours, as you recall, was about 28% this last year. The state of Washington reported that 65% of the youth returned within 1 year. They just don't have enough time to do the treatment, education, and reformation that they need. And kids, like you saw in the Measure 11 video, have the option just to sit there and do their time and not apply themselves. And the result of that is a much higher recidivism rate. So we're very comfortable with the indeterminate sentencing on the juvenile side. Fourth question had to do with the tattoo removal study. Dr. McCarthy, who was here Tuesday, reported that there was a pretty good success rate of kids that have their tattoos removed do not come back into our system. I think Representative Westland asked us to check in on those numbers because they were almost unbelievable. 1 out of 100 of the kids that had the tattoos removed had returned to our system. I think 6 out of 100 that had not had the tattoos removed. As near as we can tell, that's a very unscientific study. It's not something that we're doing as a department. It's something that's being kept by the Psychiatric Association in connection with some staff at Hillcrest. We're very encouraged by those results, but we're not saying that this is the answer to everything. I wanted to clarify, there haven't been any public funds in that program to this point. That's all been with volunteer contributions and time from the various doctors around the state who operate those laser machines. So we like the program. Dr. McCarthy's request for $65,000 was her idea. It's not something that's in the governor's revised budget. The fifth question, I believe, is from Senator Hannon, and it was, could we get a survey of the resources available at the county juvenile department level? And the short answer is not in time for this session. All the juvenile departments are independently operated by the counties. They all report to their boards of county commissioners. We do not have an administrative oversight of them. That kind of a comparison would take a long time, several months, to put together. What we can tell you is that the Oregon Juvenile Directors Association could undertake such a survey among themselves. They have an executive director and they have a staff person, and they could begin that process, but it would take several months for them to do that. They do know, they have done some work on their detention capacity. That's one part of the resource array that we can tell you about, and that information is available because they just completed a detention survey. And they're also working with us on a survey of shelter beds that are available around the state, but there is no comprehensive comparison from county to county on what kind of resources the juvenile departments have at the county level. The last time I saw one done was in 1985 when we were working on the diversion dollars, the first year the diversion dollars went to the county, and there was such a survey done, but it's been 14 years.
Thank you.
We have the reports from the county. Wouldn't that help in regards to that?
Mr. Chair, Sanchez, we have the pension plans from the county. That's true.
Right.
And we know what they plan to do with the money, the $30 million, if the $30 million comes through. What it doesn't tell us is what they already have in place. So we heard from Jimmy Brown from Oakland County, what they're doing up there. We heard from Mr. Carmichael and Mr. Joe Christie, about some of the things they do. But to put it all together in a package of what each county has in place to serve delinquent youth is not there yet.
Mr. Chair, do we have $30 million for those programs? Do we have a rundown of how, say we have $15 million, how we could cut that program in half and where we could take care and get the best size of it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tim,
like you're doing everything else, that's as far.
We're asking the counties just that very question. What if this was cut by 30%? What if this was cut by 60%?
Right.
We have not received that information back, to my knowledge. I think it's
happening through the government office.
Great. How soon will we have that?
I hope we'll have that, Senator, by the time Senate Bill 555 gets its hearing.
Okay, which part have you heard in this? You mean in Ways and Means? It's already had its hearings in the Subcommittee Committee and we're come down here and be heard in this committee. Okay.
The last item I want to speak to, and then I'm going to turn it over to Karen to talk about JAGES, is just a correction. Chair Westland questioned yesterday our sex offender reoffending number. I think Barbara McGuire testified it was somewhere around 5% of our treated sex offenders over the last 10 years have committed another sex offense. That number was incorrect. It was off, you know, from her memory, and we went back and checked on it, and it was 9%, not 5%. Still very low, but not as low as a 5% figure. So your question, Mr. Chair, was a good one. Okay.
There's been a number of questions regarding the juvenile justice information system, and Ms. Baker has a couple of extra sheets. There's some explanatory information in your notebook under tab 2, and if you would like to add this next 2 pages to it. The history on the Juvenile Justice Information System is it began in 1995-96 under Burn Grant, where we pulled together a steering committee, and one of the handouts you're getting is the membership of the steering committee that remains relatively stable since that time. That group developed a joint vision for such an information system. We used part of the Burns funds to develop the beginning module, and we piloted that module in a couple of counties. In the remaining funds for the development and implementation of JAGES were requested in the 1997-99, and we have been using those funds, and we are in the just about in the middle of the project, maybe a little bit farther ahead. If you look at the sheet that's coming around, that is not the steering committee. It's got two different things on each side. The one with those little shaded boxes at the top gives you an idea of the modules that we are developing. We have just completed the development of 3 modules, and they are the essential modules for counties to actually have the system up and running, meaning those 3 modules allow counties that are using their own system or the old, what was called the JAGES system, which was a standalone system, that they can migrate from that system to JAGES and have relatively the same functionality that they did before. The big advantage, however, is that they will all be hooked up, all the counties will be hooked up with each other and the state and able to share that information so that if a youth moves from, or a youth in Clackamas County does a crime in Washington County, Washington County will be able to look at the system and see if that youth is from Clackamas County and what the youth history is, if he's on the run from another program or anything like that. Pausing there just for a minute, if you flip that same page over, you will see the implementation schedule that we have established. We are working this spring on bringing a number of the county sites up and operational, and essentially what that means is we have to make sure that the communication lines are established. We have to make sure that the staff in those county sites are appropriately trained to operate the system. We have been going through a process with them of converting their existing data so they don't have to go back and do all the hand entry of data that they have, historical data that they want to be able to continue. And getting people used to the system, and it will be a change for people. In the early summer months, or about the early summer months, we are working with the OYA facilities. I heard Mr. Johnson say that along with or a component of the juvenile justice information system is an information system for the state, for the youth authority. Right now we are dependent upon the Department of Human Resources information system, which provides us with some information about the youth, but not their criminality or the kinds of data that we need in a juvenile justice system. So we are migrating off of the Department of Human Resources system onto the JAGE system, and our effort will be in getting our own facilities up and running. And then in late summer through the fall, we began working again with the counties as well as some of our correctional institutions. So that's the implementation schedule. If you flip back on the other page, at the same time we're doing all of this, we are continuing to work on the other modules in the system. And I think it's really the other modules that have the most interest for the policymakers. The first three modules will collect the demographic information, allow counties to, I think you heard Steve Carmichael say that it's been developed to be a system that is a case management system, so people who actually work with kids can do their work more efficiently. The modules that you don't see shaded are those that are going to collect the information around providers, the kinds of services that the youth receive, and allow us to begin to do the kind of evaluation and provide the kind of evaluation information that state and local policymakers have really been clamoring for, like how what kind of alcohol and drug treatment works with which kind of kids. And we can't give you very good information about that yet. We also, in the future modules, will be developing the interfaces. And when I was before you with the other criminal justice agencies for the two-day presentation, we talked a lot about interfaces, and that has always been a planned feature of JAGIS, that we will interface with the state police, with the Department of Corrections, and with the court system, so that we can allow those relevant parts of each of our information systems to exchange the necessary data. And we expect to have that completed by the end of the coming biennium. In terms of project development and oversight, you can see I listed the JAGIS steering committee members, and it lists Ms. Baker and Mr. McGee and another individual from DAS. They really aren't members. They're there to sort of track the money and track the process. So we have that level of oversight. We have a contracted with a group with a lot of experience in this to help us with the project management. We also have oversight contracted with the quality control. And in addition, DAS has over the last biennium made a presentation every other month on the status of the JAGIS to the JLC IMT. So the project has had a great deal of oversight, and we have worked very hard with the steering committee to have a management system that looks at evaluate the scope of the project against the time that we have and the money that we have. We can't make everybody happy and build everything for everybody. So when somebody wants something new, we put it up on the board and say, if you want this, something else has to go, or the time has to be extended. And in that way, we've been able to really manage the scope of the project and stay within budget and stay on the timelines. The downside of that is it is not a silver bullet. It's not going to meet everybody's demands. In the early stages of development, people were so excited that they actually wanted like a personalized screen where they could have just the information that they wanted. Well, you cannot build an information system that does everything for everybody, but you can build one if you put these kinds of restrictions and constraints on it. I'm happy to stop and answer any questions that you have.
Karen, I want to compliment you. That's the best presentation on JGIS I've heard yet to date. And more than that, my compatriot and colleague is to my immediate left. I never saw a pin he didn't pinch. Complimented you as well. That was a great presentation. Senator Jim.
Yeah. You're a little nervous following that.
That's good presentation.
That, and you basically, after I told him I wanted to ask the question, you got into it more. I'd like to hear from Daff, the part that Daff played, Maziati's outfit played in this overall development. Did they develop the process where it's compatible throughout the system? Or sounds like they did, and that's being done.
Mr. Chair, Senator Timms, Carl Weineke from Matt Stan Maziati's shop is a regular attendee for the steering committee, as I am. And they, R&D has been involved in this through the beginning. They have provided a sense of consulting role to the agency, to as the agency and the county and the steering committee develop the design for this system. They worked with the agency to ensure it maintained the statewide standards for the criminal justice system. It would not, I think, be fair to say that DAS in any way designed the system. I think there are too few of us, and I don't think we have the expertise in the juvenile justice system to have done that. The steering committee with a couple of very good consultants came up with what I think is one of the best designs and one of the best executed development projects that I've ever seen in information systems, and I've got some private sector experience there as well in earlier life. We provided some assistance, I think. We tried to do some reality checking with them. We attempted to provide some guidance, but Karen and the steering committee have done an excellent job of really putting together, when you think of it, a really challenging project. I'm not sure of any other place in the country where you're bringing the state and 36 different counties all to share a single case management system where you bring the thing up and you see information on one kid from every time they've had contact in any county in the state. So they're doing a great job, and while we'd love to take the credit, we can only say we played a smaller help role.
Okay, the technology costs and gas, I think, around $292
million. Statewide, sure.
Yeah, statewide. Now, are you paying a fee in this system to DAS, or do you have your independent system evidently? And I'm sorry that I don't know this better and remember better that you're paying for this yourself, or is it paid for through fees through DAS?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pence, the consulting assistance that we've gotten from DAS, we have not paid for on a consulting system basis. I think it's part of what the range of services that we get from DAS. However, on some of the more technical pieces of the line costs and actually working the hardwire system does go through DAS, and there is some kind of pricing agreement that regulates that.
Okay.
Yes, and it's on the DAS. The database is maintained by DAS.
So you're part of that $92 million.
For those components.
Right, because that's interesting to me. As we look at that in DAS, you know, it relates to a system of this magnitude. It's out there and it justifies the dollars that in some cases are going into this area, and it goes into a lot of different areas, and we haven't even looked at this part
of it. The piece of the budget, or the part of the cost of the system that's in our budget, is the line cost. The monthly line costs for each county to be linked up, and those are not insignificant. And we maintain those, or through a contract, pay for and maintain those line costs.
Mr. Chair, when you say linked up, is the system with that CRT or what have you into their communication system?
Yes. And it's been different.
It'd be different than phone services. It's a different entity. It would be through a computer. I shouldn't say that. I'm a technology idiot. So technology cost above your regular phone services.
Mr. Chair and Senator Timms, that's right, and it varies somewhat from county to county depending upon how large the county is and what their overall communication
bandwidth and all those things.
Exactly. But this project has paid for establishing and maintaining the maintenance of that kind of hard communication link.
That's great. Thank you.
Any other questions for Karen? No more compliments.
More than deserved. That was great.
Okay, we're going to hear from staff now on some of the citizens' rights.
This is just some additional information to follow up on earlier questions, so I just wanted to get this in before the agency makes a final shift. The first, I have given each of you a memorandum. The first question that it responds to was on comparative cost of the military department's youth challenge program compared to OYA's boot camp. And they're not directly comparable programs for the reasons that I explained in the memo, but in trying to get a apples-to-apples comparison as much as I could, we came up with a per-day estimate for each of the youth challenge programs, the accountability work-study camps, and then the secure correctional facilities, and then an annualized cost, recognizing that the Oregon Youth Challenge Program doesn't operate on an annual basis, but to, again, try and compare apples and apples, and set a daily cost that we came up with and annualize that so that you could see the differences there. And then the second piece of information is starts on the bottom of page one, and the actual information is on page two, is a bit more complicated and less comparable, if you will. We got information on recidivism from the Department of Corrections for all crimes and then for property crimes. I've substantially footnoted this because of the differences in what's being measured and the differing groups that are being measured. Basically, Department of Corrections measures recidivism at 12, 24, and 36 months. These numbers reflect just those folks that went from prison to parole or post-prison supervision, which is comparable to youth coming out of the Oregon Youth Authority. But their definition is that the person needed to be convicted of a new felony within a particular time period. The Oregon Youth Authority information on their performance measures reflects folks that come back into OYA custody for whatever reason, and it could be a new felony, but it could be a failure to comply with the terms of parole. For example, they're not staying in school or something like that. And right now, the data system doesn't split out the reasons for folks coming back. And so, as I say, that's not exactly comparable information, not even close to comparable information. I'm sure the new JAGA system will be able to provide finer detail in terms of reasons for folks coming back into close custody. And then just for comparison purposes, I added the recidivism information from the statewide juvenile justice system report that we received in the booklet. And that is based on crimes referred to juvenile departments, excluding runaway status offenses and violations. So that is crimes and not necessarily parole revocation. And one of the pieces of information that Department of Corrections provided me was that recidivism is correlated to age as well as to what kind of offense it was. And although the Oregon Youth Authority information isn't split out by age, the County Juvenile Department information, this report did indicate that the very young or the older juveniles were less likely to reoffend than that middle age group. And the middle age group would be in large part what the Oregon Youth Authority is dealing with there. So that may raise more questions than it actually answers on recidivism, but at least it does give you some numbers for it.
Rick, did you get a copy of this?
Yes.
I guess I'd have to ask why it doesn't look too good if you look at the recidivism numbers. I understand that the population, maybe I'm misreading, but the population is the toughest. You're dealing maybe with the most likely to reoffend and stuff. So any comments to make that clear for me?
Well, Mr. Chair, President Schrager, our recidivism numbers compared to other states, other programs that do what we do, they're outstanding. I mean, I think last session we brought in a state-by-state comparison of youth authority type recidivism numbers, and ours was 10 to 15 points lower than the national average. These are apples to oranges, as Sheila has pointed out. It's virtually impossible to make these comparisons. We try to avoid these at all whenever possible with the adult correction system or any other system that's doing things differently. There's 100 variables. It's a very difficult thing to measure, and unless it's done absolutely consistently, there is no comparison. So 28% that we're looking at today is gotten better every year for the last 5 years. We continue to work on it, and you know, when you think that these are kids that come back for a variety of reasons, not just committing law violations, there is no comparison.
I think Representative Schrader and Chair Westland, that probably to keep anything in mind and looking at the Department of Corrections data and the Youth Authority data, is the Department of Corrections is based on the commission of another felony.
Conviction
of another felony, whereas we will bring youth back for not going to school, which certainly it isn't a felony. And that's an important difference, because we need to have those kind of sanctions on kids.
Right. Yeah, but if you look at the figures, I mean, it's like to me all we have to do is not arrest them until they're adults, put them in the DLC, and we pick up 15 points of, you know, improved recidivism. Huh? Makes sense to me.
A better answer is don't arrest anybody until they're 40 and there isn't any
Yeah, then we have absolutely no recidivism.
See how much money I'm saving you, Jim?
You're brilliant.
Hey, we're just trying to find the military budget. I'm getting closer. We provide the comic relief at no additional charge. Rick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to wrap up if you've got a few more minutes. We started last week with, in our overview, explaining that our mission statement was a combination of four basic principles of juvenile justice, public safety, accountability, reformation, and prevention. And our early focus in our first 3 years of existence as an agency was on public safety, and I appreciate Senator Tim's comments about how efficiently we were able to get our facilities up and running. And by the way, Senator Stahl told me that when she left that you would take over for her and took care of us in the budget building process.
No way.
We do need to turn to away from public safety a little bit and concentrate on reformation, prevention, and accountability, and that's what this budget does. When we talk about accountability, we're not just talking about it in terms of holding the youth accountable. We're talking about it and holding ourselves accountable to you. And through this week and last week, there has been some frustration expressed on the difficulty that the juvenile justice system has in producing data and producing measurable outcomes. While we share that frustration with you and always have, it's reflecting on when I first started delivering budget testimony, and it was in 1983, and it was in this very room. And I remember preparing for that, thinking, how am I going to ask these people for money if I can't give them any measurable outcomes of what we've been accomplishing? And that question has always haunted me as we've gone through the years. So in 1995, when we became a state department, one of the very first things we did was go after the federal burn grant money that was available to develop information systems. And we got support from the Attorney General's office, we got support from the Governor's office, and we competed for that money, and we got $400,000 to begin to design the CHAGES system. We designed it, we successfully piloted it, and in 1997 we got the COP funding from the Oregon Legislature for that program, as Sharon has described it. was a very ambitious and some have said a very risky effort, but we think it was well worth it. Building the JAJIS system was the first step to unify the juvenile justice system on a statewide basis and to give us the capability to measure what we do and then to report that back in turn to the legislature. Second step is to adopt performance-based outcomes so that we can standardize what it is we measure and ensure that those measured outcomes are in fact meaningful. A performance-based outcome project and is that opportunity. And we didn't spend a lot of time on that in our budget presentation, but you will find that in the books on under Appendix tab number 6. We're the only state in the nation that is fully participating in this national project. We will have between 50 and 60 individual measurable outcomes for the within the broad-based areas of security, safety, border, programming, health and mental health, and justice. We will be well ahead of where we are today and well ahead of any other state in the country. And the combination of having a juvenile justice information system that ties in the juvenile departments with the state and the performance-based project should go a long way to alleviating our frustration and, in turn, next session, alleviating some of your frustration. Connected with that, I'd like to respond to the Secretary of State's audit report on the juvenile justice system, remembering they described the system as not Oregon Youth Authority, but those 36 county juvenile departments, as well as some of our private providers. The auditors looked at 7 counties, and what they concluded was there was a lack of data and a lack of their ability to provide reports because of that lack of data. The result was the inability to complete the audit. In fact, what we had is an audit report without any recommendations. The audit merely confirmed what we, the Youth Authority, and the Juvenile Department directors already knew, is that we couldn't produce the data, we couldn't produce the measurable outcomes. That's why they joined us in 1995 in a partnership to develop the JAJIS system. So we're 3 years into that now, 4 years into that now. And we were quite clear with the auditors about that when they began that audit. You heard testimony from Steve Carmichael and Joe Christie of the Juvenile Department about their commitment to the Juvenile Justice Information System. You heard them talk about the successful co-management partnerships that we've developed. You heard about shared training projects, common recidivism definition that we've built, and the common risk assessment tool that we're working on jointly. You heard from Arnie Green, Pam Patton, and Benson Myers, some of our private providers, that they are better off today than they were last year because of the BRS funding structure that we have implemented. It doesn't solve all the problems, but it solves a lot of them, and it also saves $1 million in general funding. OIA is taking a leadership role in bringing the juvenile justice system together. It will not happen overnight, and one of the reasons is that we recognize and we respect that Oregon prides itself in strong local government, local independence, and local decision-making. Among the advantages of local control in this business is the ability to do some pilot projects, like the Deschutes County Community Justice Pilot and like the gang intervention project you heard about from Jimmy Brown of Multnomah County. And that's one of the reasons that we organized the agency into 5 regions, so that we could capture the unique characteristics of Oregon's varied communities while still delivering a statewide service. You heard from Chief Ruskowski and Sheriff Ramirez that the Youth Authority is cooperating with law enforcement. Not only are we improving public safety by the expansion of our bed space and our county detention centers, but we're also sitting at the planning table across the state at the local public safety coordinating council. You heard from Steve Dole that we're responsive to the victims' issues, and you also heard, in fact, from Kathy Osborne of the Juvenile Rights Project, who represents the agency that sued us in 1979, and it's their business to be a watchdog agency, and I was very moved by her positive comments that we are open and sincere about providing a safe environment for the youth committed to our custody. Finally, you heard from Portland businessman Harold Williams that OIA is responding to the special challenges of working through the diversity issues and trying to become a culturally competent agency
that's responsive to Oregon's minority community. We're very proud of our accomplishments, and we feel that we're closer today than ever before in bringing Oregon's juvenile justice system together as a system. There's still a lot of gaps to fill, and the governor's recommended budget attempted to fill some of those gaps with packages for staff training, for capital construction, and for mental health assessments. Our governor's revised budget, unfortunately, had to sacrifice some of those packages. It is our hope, however, that the high-risk juvenile crime prevention package is fully funded, because it is clearly a preferred social policy to reach youth before they come into the youth authority, before they commit serious crimes, than after they do. But even with the crime prevention package, there's going to be gaps in service, such as shelter care, mental health services, but we will be working on those issues with the juvenile department directors during the interim, try to come with some back next session with some better ideas. As you discuss this revised budget before and during the work session, you will be tempted to compare us with adult corrections. My only regret from the last 2 weeks is that we were unable to get you out on the tour. I think seeing what we do and talking to the youth and seeing our staff work with kids, you get a much clearer idea of what juvenile corrections is all about. We are not adult corrections any more than we are a child welfare agency. Juvenile corrections is its own discipline. We hold youth offenders accountable for their adult-like criminal behavior while keeping in mind that they are youth who are much more capable of change than their adult counterparts. And although some do graduate to the big leagues, the majority do not, and some, like Mary Kimmel, who you heard from on Tuesday, overcome all the odds with the help of the staff at Hillcrest and with incredible people like foster parent Kate Kilfoyle, and end up going to college and fulfilling their dreams and having families and being very productive citizens. So with that, I just want to thank the committee for your courtesy and your interest and your inquisitive questions, and Chair Weston for your leadership, and that concludes our budget presentation.
Good close.
Any questions?
That's a speechless circle as we call it.
Thank you very much. I go back to one of the first things I said when we started off, 10 days ago or 5 days ago, or 6 months ago or whatever it was. Not only was Karen's presentation on pages and stuff when I heard, this is the best organized book I've seen to date yet.
Yeah, it is. Well organized.
Yeah, we need to follow, logically laid out type presentation.
The committee would like to recognize Linda Gessler, who's been in the back of the room. That is her work. She could stand up and...
Way to go. Yeah, stand. Yeah, give her a hand. Good job.
I
can't tell you how much it has helped. This is critical for us.
That's true. And there are people back in our office listening, Cindy Booth, Dan Mogeson, Phil Cox, and others who are huddled around the speaker. Thanks, folks, for helping.
One point. I thought the presentation was great. I'm very good. Other than I'm nervous about the county situation. I've had more problems with counties this session in so many areas to find the priorities or this or that. But I'm nervous when you said that you wanted the juvenile part of it to be done in a prorated basis of what we do if we 80% funded it, 90% funded, and have them come back with it. I would suggest that you get on their case big and that they get it done, because they have a tendency to just not get you the information. And that's going to be important to the juvenile area, I think.
But at the same time, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but I mean, a very high percentage of the counties have filed and their plans have been, stamped with the Good Housekeeping seal of approval.
That's right, Mr. Chair. They're all in and they're all approved. The question is, if there's less than $30 million, what do they do? What change? How does their plan change?
And why wouldn't we do that with them when we do it with state government? When you're asked to make cuts? in the process, we should ask counties to do the same thing.
Each and every one of you, thank you very much. This is a good presentation.
We are adjourned.